Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sort of 40-year career, mainly in sort of gossip columns or diaries.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, not all. I mean, I started as a serious journalist, believe it or not, because I was London correspondent of the Irish Press Group throughout the late 70s and early 80s when the Troubles were on, and having to cover really serious stories. And in a way, it was much more fulfilling. But they were closing the London office. I started to do shifts in London News Diary, and that drifted into gossip. And from, you know, in a way, you know, you become sort of pigeonholed. I prefer gossip and serious news in the end.
Yeah. And what's the sort of the best story you've had, do you think, or the one that you're kind of proudest of?
It's a complete blur. You know, there's no real story that stands out. You know, on a serious news basis, I'm quite proud of I covered the SAS assassination of the three IRA people in Gibraltar.
Yeah.
And basically, I discovered that, you know, the SAS had said that they'd shot them once in the head, and I found the undertaker in Gibraltar who said, his English wasn't very good, but I said, well, there's just one shot. He said, no, how you say riddled. I mean, that was a serious news story, but there isn't really any great outstanding scoop. Basically, it's just, you know, all diary stories are revelations in a sense, or discoveries, but none of them matter that much. They're all, it's really entertainment rather than campaigning or being serious about journalism. It's more diverting and show busy.
It strikes me that like diary people tend to sort of do the job for 2 or 3 years, as far as I can tell. And not that many stay along for a long time. So it must be incredibly hard to constantly come up with the original stuff that no one else has got. It's not like you've got the diary to fall back on so much, have you?
Well, it's the one news part diary. Of the paper where, I mean, here in the Mail, for example, there'd be a news list, a foreign list, and a city list. And these are all stories that are reacting to events. Diaries, you tend to have to come up with something, originate something about something. You can't just, you know, okay, do a picture caption of somebody, but basically you have to originate stories. You have to find stories. People tell you things at parties, and that is the great tragedy, that people don't go out anymore. You know, you have to know the person you're either phoning up because you've met them at a party or you've had a lunch with them. And I do think that diaries are the most difficult part of the newspaper to do, but in effect, really, the change is phenomenal in the newspapers, because when I started, the diaries were confined to a page. Now virtually all the paper is diary. You know, it's all light stuff, reality TV, show business, Hollywood, and it's not confined to the diary page. I mean, Jeff Levy, who's a veteran who's still surviving, nearly up to 80, Jeff was William Hickey on the Daily Express long before I was, and when he was William Hickey on the Daily Express, they had a staff 12 in the diary. 12.
Wow.
And but they would actually do two editions. They would do a diary, you know, up to tea time, and then they'd go out to stories and come back and write for the later editions. And having a staff of 12, now, you know, you're lucky that I'm a Hardcastle, but it's only Peter Mackay and I, which is a small column. But Sebastian Shakespeare, who would be the inheritor of, I suppose, Dempster, has two full-time, and that's it. But ultimately, that's the way it goes. It's not, the industry's changed so much.
Any story, I mean, it strikes me you had to be incredibly kind of thick-skinned and have a sort of brass neck as well to ask the questions you ask of people who you're quite friendly with. But is there anything that makes you blush now, looking back on it?
Well, no, I did include the story of Sean Connery, which sort of showed up. He was famous for being a tightwad, and I think I worked on The Standard at the time, and he owned the play Art, which was a French play. In fact, it was his wife owned it. But it opened in London with Ken Stott and Albert Finney and Tom Courtney. It was a threesome. And normally an opening party, it depends how lavish it is. It's usually, you know, maybe some champagne, certainly finger food, and red and white wine. And Connery hosted the party at the Mall Gallery in the Mall, and it was a pay bar. And that was unheard of, even in those days. I mean, the first nights were first nights. And I remember chatting to Albert Finney, who had brought down his two middle-aged sisters from Leeds for the first night. And he just grabbed me and said, I cannot believe it. I'm starring in this play, and I have to buy the drinks for my two sisters. And he pointed over at Connery, who was standing near the entrance, with these two very heavyweight sort of bodyguards with him, these goons. So I went over and introduced myself, and I'm 6'2", and Connery is probably about the same. And I said, I'm John McKinney from the Standard. Just ask Albert Finney was wondering why he had to buy his sister's drinks. Why do you have a pay bar? And all Connery did was incline his head and grunt just slightly. And I suddenly felt these sort of arms under my oxters, and he got smaller and smaller and smaller as I was thrown out into the mall. But he never spoke. You know, he just never spoke. And that was, as far as Connery was concerned, you know, he didn't need to explain himself. But that was the only time I... No, the second time I was thrown out of the party was confronting Frank McCord, when Harris had told me that Richard Harris, they were both from Limerick, and Richard was at that time he was living in the Savoy Hotel, and McCord, who had been a sort of a down at heel lecturer in New York, had written Angela's Ashes, which is this very sort of grim account of his childhood in County Limerick. And I used to drink with Harris in the coal hole. He was very lonely, and he'd come back to having a few beers, and we were having a drink one afternoon, And I said, I've got an invitation to the launch of, well, not the launch, but the celebration of 1 million copies of Angela's Ashes in paperback from Penguin. And Penguin were then located just round the corner on the Strand from the Savoy. And I said to Richard, you know, you're a Limerick man. You know, first of all, he called them a four-letter word that rhymes with stunt. And then I said, what's wrong with that? He says, I thought you were called from Limerick. He says, I'll tell you the final quote. He said, when I was touring with Camelot, the music he owned in America, I was in New York, and Frank McCourt's mother was called Angela. And in fact, a slight side interest in that was that Frank and his brother Malachi, Malachi's still alive, used to tour Manhattan bars and do a two-man show about their deprived childhood. And the mother used to turn up and shout, lies, lies, that never happened. So when she died, Harris said that they couldn't afford to ship her ashes back to Limerick, their native Limerick, to scatter in the Shannon. So he said he provided the money, and according to Harris, they went to a cheap shipper in Queens who lost the ashes. So Harris insisted he wouldn't go to the party, but he said, you go and ask Frank about that. So I turned up at the boardroom in Penguin. Frank was being lionized by all the sort of young girls from publishing about this and talking about this awful childhood he had. And I went up, I was then working for the Express, and I said, oh, Frank, I'm John McEnany from the Daily Express. And he was very, very amicable. And then I said, I'd like to ask you, what happened to your mother's ashes? And he immediately grabbed me by the throat, put me up against the wall. Richard Harris sent you, effing Harris sent you. And I said, I couldn't speak. And I was asked to leave the party. So the following week, I went back to the coal hole, and Harris was there looking over, drinking his pint of Boddington's, looking over his half glasses, and said, well, and I said, I nearly got bloody strangled. He thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. He's a chancer. He did lose his mother's ashes. So about Harris died in 2001, and then shortly after that, there was a party at the Irish Embassy for a book that Frank had written called Teacher Man, about his time as a teacher in New York. And I went up to him and I said, do you remember me? And surprisingly, he said, I do. And he said, I'm really sorry about that. He said, you're quite right, we did lose the ashes, but not to a shipper. We left him in a bar in Manhattan. And so I was vindicated in that sense.
That's a wonderful story, though. Did that story make it into the diary?
I think I might have written it in the Express at the time, but I don't think I explained. I was sort of too embarrassed by the thrown out of the party. I just sort of claimed it as an allegation made by Harris and denied by Frank, but I couldn't really shame myself by saying I landed up out in the street again.
So how did you manage to reconcile yourself with Richard Harris? Because there's one or two things in the book which kind of made me thought, a little bit naughty. But the one of them was that he told you something off the record about his son's health, which you sold to a diary.
Daily Star, and I was then London correspondent of the Irish Press, and it was a fantastic period because you could do anything you wanted. You could do news, you could do interviews with stars, because none of the big names were. Dublin wasn't on the circuit for, you know, if Norman Mailer was coming over to promote a book or Betty Davis a movie, he didn't go to Dublin. So he had this wonderful opportunity to meet these people. But basically with Harris, I did an interview with him. He was then living in a sort of a boutique hotel up in Holland Park, and we got on swimmingly. But he then said, off the record, and it was off the record, that his son Jared had who was then very young, had to go to Minnesota for some sort of drug rehabilitation treatment. So of course I wrote the interview up for the Irish Press, didn't mention this, I then flogged it to, it was then Peter Torrey's diary on the Star, and the Star, which is then owned by the Express fully, and Lord Stevens had then lost a huge amount of money on a libel action involving Geoffrey Archer, the famous, was it Monica Copley? You remember, is she not fragrant?
Yes, yes.
And they were looking out they wanted to win an action. And Harris, they thought, was perfect. Harris had sued on the basis that, which is an odd basis in law. He wasn't denying it was true. He was denying that, he said it was off the record, invasion of privacy almost. But so I very naively said I'd give evidence in the court. And of course, that was the worst possible, it was a nightmare, because my employers in Dublin, were shocked because there was I appearing in all the newspapers about, you know, because Richard Harris had run around the suite chasing a chambermaid in his underpants, and that was in the interview in Ireland, and they read all this out, and of course made the papers here. And they made a great mistake with Harris at the start of the case. The troubles were still going on, and the barrister for the Express accused Harris of being a supporter of NORAD in New York. And Harris immediately said, that is not true. I recently issued a statement condemning the IRA, and as a result, I am under sentence of death and I cannot visit my aged mother in Limerick. And he then burst into tears, and two of the jurors went for their hankies, and I said, we're finished. And then when I was called as a witness, the barrister said, Mr. McGinty, how much did you get for this tittle-tattle staring at me? And Harris was in the well of the court staring up at me, and I said, £30, Your Honour. And he said, 30 pieces of silver. So the thing was settled at lunchtime. Harris got 80,000 quid. I was in, you know, more or less sacked by my job in Ireland for double jobbing. And I had a mutual friend called Jimmy the Muncher, who was a friend of Harris, and he said, Harris won't speak to me now because, you know, guilt by association. So I didn't see Harris or have any contact with him for years until one day I happened to be at a do somewhere, and I went into a card shop, Clinton Cards on the Strand, to buy a Mother's Day card for my mother. Walked into the coal hall, and there was Harris sitting over his pint looking at me, and I went up to the bar and I looked at him again, and he called me over, and I said, I'm surprised you're speaking to me. He said, why not? He said, I got 80,000 quid for FOR. Come and join me. So we sat down, and eventually after a few drinks, he saw this Mother's Day card, and he said, how much are you sending to your mother? And I said, £50. You mean, I'd come from a place called Cavan, which people are a bit like Scotsmen, are supposed to be tight. You mean Cavan B? And he said, give her £100, and then he filled in the entire card, wrote a lovely message to her, but it was covered in beer stains. And I sent off the card, and I phoned her a few days later, and she got the card. She said, I couldn't understand a word of it. And I said, Richard Harris wrote it. Oh, isn't he lovely? So we became, I suppose, friends. And I think at the heart of it, he was lonely. He was spending £2,000 a week in his suite at the Savoy. He had no real friends. His family were all scattered. And he just enjoyed talking. So we became, and the whole incident with the libel action became history. So it didn't really, it did damage us initially, but that was the end of it.
And the other thing that made me raise my eyebrows slightly in the book was the, I can't remember which paper you were at, but it was a fictional contributor fictional tipster, which you mentioned with, which you're very kind of, open about.
Yeah, well, the thing
I assume
is,
the statute of limitations is closed on that one.
Well, it is at the moment, but I was on the Times, and there was a culture then in some diaries where people paid their wives and paid their, you know, it's completely, I suppose, corrupt and fraudulent. But what I was doing was, I was actually, I'd invented a fictional contributor who was actually me, and I was paying myself. But the problem was, I was too successful. I became the most prominent contributor who was invited to parties by the paper at the time. And of course, he's ill, he can't come. And then, because a lot of the stories were TV, I was on holidays, and the editor at the time tried to contact this guy. His name was Tommy McCauley, because they asked him about it. It turned out that, you know, they couldn't find any contact with him. They found the address that, you know, the checks were going to, he didn't live in. So basically, instead of saying, good heavens, you're even more, you're even more productive in terms of stories, he invited me to resign, which I did, I had a fairly few grim years freelancing. And then this particular individual, I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and I bumped into him on the South Bank, said hello, and I didn't speak to him. And of course, by the time I got back to the office, he'd sent it slightly before the internet. He sent a huge fax explaining my shame to the entire staff, which, you know, it was a fair cop. That's why I mentioned it in the book. You know, I'm not proud of it, but I think he shouldn't pretend these things didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. And there's been strikes me that, like, reading the book and reading you know, your column now in the mail,
yeah,
it kind of sort of people you write about sort of different type of celebrity than we have that are quite so prominent now. So kind of like Lord Longford or politicians or the old school famous Hollywood actors. So kind of people who had done something with their lives. I mean, what do you make of the current crop of sort of Kim Kardashians, the reality TV, the sort of that sort of thing?
But again, it's a lack of achievement. I mean, at least people that I either had written a decent book or they'd been starred in movies, or in the case of Longford, he was a campaigner and a colourful character. A lot of the celebrities now are completely meaningless. I mean, they haven't any sort of clout or any sort of, what do you call it, hinterland. And they're very, very much here today, gone tomorrow. But because of the phenomenon of social media and YouTube and the whole Twitter and the rest, the whole sort of landscape has changed. It's not like in the old days where people just had TV, had cinema, had magazines. Now it's a completely different game, and people are instant. And then there's the instant celebrity, the person who's famous for 15 minutes with Big Brother or with I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And they're not celebrities. I mean, I'm sure they're household names somewhere, but they go over my head.
And do you get any stories from Twitter or Facebook yourself? Or
we use it quite a bit, and Twitter in particular. I mean, there's politicians like Nicola Sorbs who are obviously consciously trying to be amusing and offensive on Twitter, and they're always, because of the nature of Hardcastle, which is a sort of a very short pithy 6 or 7 stories, they're almost like sound bites, they're almost like Twitter actually. You do tend to pick up on this, and a huge amount of material we get from contributors is taken from Twitter or taken from Facebook or taken from social media, whereas in the old days it used to be magazines or Page Six and New York Times, or New York Daily News rather. And everything is instantaneous. I mean, even as we're speaking, we can look down on the mail online operation, which is like, you know, a terracotta army of people just churning out stuff round the clock. You're writing about people you're never going to meet. They're transcribing stuff in magazines, and it's instantaneous. You know, everything is sort of there is no delay now in terms of disclosure.
Well, what do you think? I mean, you talk about it in the book a little bit, don't you? At the end there, what do you think about the way journalism's changed from the going out, the lunching, the meeting people, drinking, to the sort of mail online and elsewhere approach of people being really manacled to a desk and producing, you know, 5 or 6 stories a day or whatever?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's as much fun in it for a start, and there is a nostalgia element of it. I mean, the thing about Fleet Street was it was overmanned and overpaid and, you know, overdrunk basically. But the fact was it was fun, and people did actually have human contact with, you know, you went to parties, you went to pubs, you went to launches, whereas a lot of the people now don't. There is no interaction at all between the person who's writing the story, because they're transcribing it from a magazine, from somebody who transcribed from something else, who got it from a publicist, who didn't have any real sort of sit-down chat. And it's all so controlled now. Everything is sort of deals with publicists where you do, you don't write about this and we give you that.
Yeah.
And there isn't an understanding that, you could actually pick up the phone and ring somebody who you met, who happens to be in the news, and do it, you know, talk to them. And I think that is a great pity. And there is, in the early days of diaries, in my diaries, a big nightmare was libel. It's now privacy. You have this completely bizarre situation where people will happily post Instagram pictures of the children bathing in mystique, and then suddenly say privacy over something else. I mean, it's a sort of a schizophrenia of celebrity where, you know, on the one hand, they crave publicity and they allow access, and then on the other hand, they suddenly get a legal warning saying privacy, you know, stop standing outside my house or stop photographing when the story doesn't sort of suit them.
And has that had a sort of like significant like chilling effect, if you like, on what you can do now compared to before? You know, in terms of and in terms of what the public knows about the people whose, you know, books they're buying and
I think it is a pity. I mean, the problem is it's a rich man's game, because it's the rich people who get the injunctions, the rich people who get the lawyers. It's not poor people or people who are disadvantaged are still can be exploited by newspapers or can be and that's a sad thing. It's a good thing that there is more concern over privacy and more what would you call it, discretion. But on the other hand, people who are in the public eye and richly deserve to be exposed for what they do can afford spending a fortune, and you know, there are injunctions you and I know of at the moment. They can afford it, ordinary people can't.
The so the last few years the press has written a lot about first of all hacking, and then Operation Elvedon with 65 journalists arrested. Was hacking ever something that you came on your radar? Were you aware that it was going on?
No. I mean, the most that you know you would ever do, ask a policeman to help you with tracing that phone or a phone number or a number plate, and that was all, you know, slightly dodgy. But the whole scale hacking that we saw at News International, where you're hacking into phones, that certainly never it was never a practice in diaries, and it may be that there were people who were doing that practice that might then sell you a story, but you'd be unaware of where it came from. And ultimately, I mean, the famous story about Tom Bradbury, who was a great friend of Prince William's, and it was Prince William had injured his leg. I think he was still at Eton, and he told Bradbury. And of course, Bradbury was worried that people thought he was leaking the story. That's where they got in equipment to discover where it was coming from. And that sort of very, very quietly, almost like a sort of a long sort of trail of gunpowder, led to the whole sort of exposure. It was a completely immoral practice, but it also involved, I mean, the police, for example, that drama that started last night, National Treasure with Robbie Coltrane, and it makes very clear that, you know, this guy is arrested for a historical sexual allegation, but it suddenly splashed all the papers because the police sell the story. And that's what I remember years ago when I was covering the I used to go to all the Labour and Tory conferences. We always got indiscreet politicians, and there was Sir Nicholas Scott, who was then an ex-minister of Northern Ireland, MP for Chelsea. And we were at a party in the Irish Embassy, had a party in Bournemouth. And I'll never forget, the last thing I heard as we were pulling down the barriers was the ambassador saying, "A large scotch for Sir Nicholas." And I bumped into the following morning, and he looked absolutely wretched. And I said, "You know, but did you stay long?" He said, "I don't know how I got home, I can't remember." And of course, what had happened was he'd collapsed, and the police had found him, and they got him home. But that evening, the sun splashed on the story, because the police had stole the story of Nicholas Scott's disgrace. He couldn't remember; he was drunk. But I mean, that combined with the hacking was all sort of very, very grubby. And I mean, the way the police are much more, what would you call it, enthusiastic and vehement with various sort of hounding of pressmen, because in a way they're conscious of their own guilt in the matter.
And the other side of it was the payments, which struck me, obviously a lot of Sun journalists were through the courts on that. And it seemed that a lot of other journalists felt sort of there but for the grace of God, because there's such a obviously a culture of paying for stories.
Journalists
themselves don't necessarily interrogate whether someone's given them a really great story, say, "Well, you know, it's not for you to kind of try and knock it down, is it?"
But, exactly. I mean,
did you feel any sympathy for them, and you think that other people could have, you know?
Well, no, I think that the culture was you pay for information. I mean, diaries in particular always paid for information. And I see no harm in that, in the sense that, you know, it's a commodity to be bought. It depends on who's selling it and where they got it from. But if it's a story, it's somebody would ring you up and say, "Oh, I've got this story about so-and-so's marriage breakup, or so-and-so having a fight. I want 500 quid for it," or whatever. Whereas you say, "Okay, we pay you that," and it's a transaction. If the story's true, it's true, and it appears in the newspaper. But I think it's sort of the money aspect of it, I think, grossly exaggerated, because, for example, in when Nigel Dempster was in his prime 20 years ago, the going rate for a lead story in a diary was about 300 quid. It's still 300 quid, you know, and it's not a secret, but in Hardcastle, you know, we pay £80 for a tip, like somebody ringing up about a politician doing something. But it was £80 in 1997. So, you know, the golden era of huge payments is all over. I mean, yeah. And also not just with paying for information. Book serialisations, I mean, people used to get 80,000 or 90,000 quid. That is not the case anymore. The Plimsoll line has been way lower for payments for anything.
So the book doesn't dwell too much on your time at the Daily Mail, does it? Which perhaps is a discretion on your part.
Well, it is slightly not so much a discretion as it was. It's the last sort of phase of my life. Most recently, I probably if the book does well, I'll go back and do a second one. there was not a lot of interesting stuff happened to me at the Mail. So in a sense. And it is more recent, whereas a lot of the other stuff is, I mean, it's 10 years or more since I left the Express, and just 20 years or more since I worked for the Times and the Standard. So, in a way, it was historically easier to do.
Yeah. There's one reasonably colourful quote from your current boss, Paul Dacre, in there. Yeah. Is he sort of content for that to be in there, or is he not?
I haven't asked him. I haven't asked, because he promised to read the book on holiday, but... I mean, which colourful quote? I mean, in relation
to... He talked about the Irish and...
But that is... I haven't asked him about that. He may... I had just arrived from the Express and I was doing a column called With the Whispers, which was a gossip column. But I used to go to pre-planning meetings. And Dacre was an extraordinary revelation in terms of... I mean, he's a hugely driven man. He's totally committed to everything he does. But I think secretly he's quite a comedian. I think basically he doesn't actually. He's a very funny man. He pretends not to be. And that was an incident when my first month or two there. There was this planning meeting. We all have to come up with ideas for the paper, and we're all sitting around in your shirt sleeves because you're not really wearing a jacket in the Daily Mail. And somebody came up with this idea that the Remembrance Sunday was coming up and poppies hadn't been selling very well. So Paul said, right, let's do a Vox Pop, or as he said, a Vox Poppy. We all sort of slapped our thighs. And then Colin Gibson was then the sports editor, and he was sitting next to me, and he said, Colin, have you got a poppy? And I knew for a fact that Colin did not have a poppy in his jacket. And he said, yes, boss, I've got a poppy. And he said, wicked, as he called me. And I said, no. And he said, you treacherous Irishman. You left the lights on in Dublin so the Germans could bomb Belfast. You refuelled the U-boats off the coast of Galway. You signed the book of condolence when Hitler died in a German embassy in Dublin. You're a treacherous, treacherous Irishman. And I protested, but Paul, I wasn't even born. And that was my first experience of Paul. And only in retrospect, I realised that it's all tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
You know, he... I don't think he genuinely believes that the Irish did, but he left the lights on in Dublin to guide the German bombers to Belfast.
What do you think makes a good gossip writer or diary writer? What's the secret, if you like?
Well, you have to have you can't be in awe of the people that you're writing about. You can't be sycophantic. You have to be you have to be honest and clear. You ask them a question, okay, if they're not going to answer it, they won't. But I think too many people sort of don't ask questions and also sort of stand back and almost sneakily observe people. And I think you can't do that. It's not honest or fair. You're not going to be popular. One of my great heroes or heroines is Helen Minsky, who's just recently retired, who worked for Dempster for 20 or 30 years. And Helen would encapsulate the perfection of a diary writer. She would have a story that was unpleasant for somebody, but she'd ring that person, or if she was at a party, she'd confront them. And she would specifically say, look, this is what I'm going to write. And they could either hang up, or they could get annoyed, or they could, in some cases, they would contact the editor and ask for, and in fairness to Paul, he would never succumb to that. But a small example, Victor Chandler, not that long ago, a few years ago, Victor Chandler, the bootmaker who's based in Gibraltar, his young wife ran off with his nephew, and somehow Helen got his phone number. And the first thing she said when she called him, "Is that Victor Chandler?" "Yes, I'm your nemesis." And sort of, I was watching this, and then she explained in great detail what, you know, that this is the story, and he was, he wasn't very, very happy about it. But then she said, "I'll call you back this afternoon and we go over it." And by the time she called him back, first of all, he'd absorbed the shock. The story was true.
Yeah.
And in fact, the worst part of that whole experience for him was not what appeared in the mail. It was having having Helen Minsky call him, "I am your nemesis," down the phone. But it was the honesty of it, and the fact that it wasn't sort of, "Oh, don't worry, we won't write that," and "Oh no, we'll be very." And then when the person picks up the paper and finds that the promise has been reneged upon, that causes far more upset, because, "Oh, you told me you wouldn't do this, you wouldn't do that." So ultimately, I think it's a dying breed, because there's very, very few diaries left in the sense of the old-fashioned sort of the Dempster or the old Ross Benson or the old William Hickey. And it's now more about television and celebrity rather than in the old days it used to be about aristocrats and racing people. And it has broadened, where some of the people in diaries I've never heard of, and again we're going back to the Kardashian and the rest of it. But I think that I don't think there are enough diaries. I mean, the Times dropped theirs, now they've restored it. And I think it's healthy to have competition between people who are, in various types of gossip, doing different types of stories.
And there seemed to be in the book a prodigious amount of drink taken as well.
Yeah, well, I think it might be slightly exaggerated. Yeah. I wouldn't be allowed today.
That's what I was thinking.
The thing is that a lot of these people, you expect you to drink with them. I mean, it's a bit like, maybe it's cocaine now, I don't know, I'm too old to know. But the point is that there was a culture, certainly in Fleet Street, not just in diaries, but, I mean, people drank a lot. You know, it really was. Chris Williams, a colleague who's now retired, told me when he was editor of the Scottish Daily Express, there was one particular guy, there was a great culture of leaving your jacket at the back of the door and dashing down to the Pop and J if you were in the old Express. But in the Glasgow office of the Mail, there was a chap who always snuck out to the pub, and he came back after about an hour, and Chris said to him, "Where have you been?" And he said, "The library." And he looked at his head and said, "Is it snowing in the library?" Because his head was covered in snow, because he'd been out of the pub. But all of that is gone. And a good thing, the problem is, it's gone from one extreme, which is too much drinking, too much carousing, people ruining their health and their careers. Now it's the opposite. Nobody drinks. I mean, it's just, it's completely, it's almost a sort of cardinal sin to have a drink at lunchtime.
Yeah, which is a shame. Do you have any scurrilous gossip about Fleet Street you'd like to share?
I'm trying to think. No, well, the old Fleet Street is the new Fleet Street.
The new Fleet Street.
Oh, I don't know. No, I don't think so. I think it's... although, you see, we're really scattered now as well. I mean, it's the old village of Fleet Street's gone, where, you know, you've got the Canary Wharf, Victoria, Kensington. So journalists don't see much of each other.
Yeah.
And in fact, out here in Kensington, it's considered like quite an overnight market to go to an oldie lunch in the Simpsons in the Strand, because it's so far away. People don't go out and they don't really mix and mingle. When all the newspapers pre-murder were in Fleet Street, people would go out at lunchtime and you'd pick up a job. Everybody would go to Elvino's or to the Punch, and you'd hear on the grapevine there's a job going in our place. So they were never advertised. People just said, "Oh, I'll put your name on." You knew each other. And in a way, that was probably a good side effect of the social drinking, as it were. There's a great story of the great Brian Vine, who was involved in the Ronnie Biggs great train robbery story, and the finding of Biggs in Brazil. But when he was on the Express, and the Express is located on the Ludgate end of Fleet Street, and Elvino's is about, let's say, a quarter of a mile up the near there. And Brian is on his way up to friends on his way up to Albina's, and a guy comes out of Burbridge and stops. He says, "Sorry, sir, I can't stop. I'm in a taxi." Because he was claiming for a taxi. I mean, that was quite a normal thing to do, to be claiming that sort of, not just for the drink, but for the taxi, because it's non-existent.
Well, look, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thanks very much for coming on our Press Gazette podcast. Pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.